episode of Wish I Knew, a podcast where I speak with people about their careers, focusing on their success, advice, mentoring, and listening to their really interesting stories. I'm your host, Gary Nowak, and today I've got my first three-way conversation with two great friends from Australia, Levi Waters and Pete Collins. I can tell you, I was most nervous about recording this one, and it turned out to be one of my favorites. I just had the best time with these two blokes. Career background. Normally, I walk through the guest individually. However, there's so many similarities between Pete and Levi, I can group them together. They both grew up in Brisbane, both joined the Navy for the same reason, both left the Navy for the same reason, both joined consulting for the same reason. I'll provide their LinkedIn profile so you can check them out in detail. Some highlights from our conversation: how to choose between which brand of the military you'd like to join, middle of the bush or duty-free shopping in Singapore. You decide. Don't fight the why. In the military, you're given directional intent with not as much command and control as you might think. The plan is the basis for change. The course you are taking is written in pencil and can be erased. The path of least resistance. Everything they do well in business was learned in the Navy. What they look for in young people. Good advice on this. Perspective on really ambitious people. Take the opportunity that's in front of you and trust the process. The customer is always right, but the client may be wrong. Don't be afraid to challenge. Don't just be a yes person. It takes a team to get things done. Don't be afraid to share personal information. Learning what drives everyone. Okay, enough of my banter. Let me get out of your way so you can sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Levi Waters and Pete Collins. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining. Because you're Australian, I need you to put on your thickest Australian accent, because Americans love it, to increase my following. And any Australian colloquialisms that you have, throw them all out there. If I have to transcribe everything because Americans can't understand, that would be success in my mind.
No worries, mate.
Rightio.
Put another group on the barbie. We don't actually say that, by the way, Gary.
You don't?
No, they're called prawns over here.
We have to start with some structures. So I've got Levi and Pete with me. So Levi, what was your very first job, non-professional job? What'd you do?
I worked in a jewelry store as an apprentice watchmaker. Well, not really. I was on the path to be an apprentice watchmaker, but I almost got there. And the reason I did that was it was in the shopping center and air conditioned, as opposed to what my old man wanted me to do, which is to dig drains with plumbers. And so I really wanted, so it was air conditioned. You got to stand in the sort of corner of the shopping center and watch all the girls go past. And you were just sort of sitting there, and it was good. It was much better than digging trenches or unclogging drains like my old man.
How old were you?
15.
So you were smart at 15 already. You already had some insight and some vision.
Yeah, it was just, well, what was the easiest? I think that's probably the career, but what's the easiest path to avoid hard work? But get there in the end. Always goal-oriented.
Well, we're going to be tapping into that wealth of knowledge throughout the podcast. Pete, first job.
So I was the opposite and didn't have anything to do in the summer holidays. So my mother set me up with a bloke who lived down in Stanthorpe on the Queensland border. And I went down to the Ballandine post office and said, can I have a job? And they said, yes. Yeah. So I worked on a tomato farm. So the Queensland border, the Granite Belt, in summer, it's 30 degrees, it's about 80% humidity. You're working in a tomato farm, which is humid. You're working with black plastic water and green plants. And the bit they don't tell you is that the dye from the plants gets into your skin and your hands, and it literally takes weeks to come off. So you'd go back to school and you have these green hands. And I think for the first couple of days I was in the Navy, I did have green fingertips. So yeah, but
so a couple of things. 30 degrees Celsius, which is about 95 Fahrenheit. So when you're doing, so Levi's fixing watches or becoming this watchmaker, I think he's part Swiss. And he's watching girls go by. How many girls were going by when you're picking tomatoes?
Well, I worked with a girl. So there were two laborers, one girl and me. She was about the same age. The farmer used to go back to the post office, which his wife ran, and we'd have lunch and morning tea together. So I was able to converse with the other sex. It was lovely.
That's what gave you your skill sets today. How did you guys meet?
Well, we met when we joined the Navy together. So we met 19th of January 1992, about right, or the 20th?
It was the 20th because we signed up on the 21st.
Yeah.
And were we in the spa together?
No. So we both joined from the Navy from Queensland to then go to the Defence Academy in Canberra together. That's where we first met, and our lives have intersected many times over the, well, nearly 30 years, which is pretty scary.
Why did you join the Navy?
I'll go first again. You want me to go first? This is very much full credit to the boys. But I, at the time, for me, my mum and dad were not, you know, my family were not particularly wealthy. If I wanted to go to university, it was going to be a pretty tough path of finding your own way, doing the hard work, finding somewhere to live and going through that. And then also at the time, the economic conditions in Australia, late 80s, early 90s, not great. The sort of prospects were not particularly buoyant. We were coming out of the depression that we had to have, or the recession that we had to have, I should say, the Banana Republic stage. And so that wasn't this sort of greater sense of civic duty. It was actually, this is a job where I'm going to get paid to go to university. And I'll do my time, which was 7 years. And that seemed like a lifetime at that stage. And, and work out what in that 7 years, maybe I'll work out what I want to do when I grow up. And that was the right place to start.
What about you, Pete?
Probably fairly similar from Levi's perspective, but really for me, it was getting out of Brisbane and getting out of northwest Brisbane, which is not a particularly affluent area. So, yeah, and the people that I went to school with, they all live within sort of 5 kilometres, have never left that part of the world. So it was an opportunity to get out. And I'd had some connection with Navy over the past in my time. So both of my uncles were in the Navy. I'd had previous grandparents in the Navy and the armed forces as well. So it was an option, and it was a career, and there was a pathway out. So that was where I went in the classics. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, I was different. I was Navy or Army, right? And I remember being in the recruiting place, and again, this comes back to probably the first point where the Navy recruiter goes to me, he goes, "Look, if you want to join the Army, when you're in your university holidays, you're going to be out in the middle of the bush digging holes. Well, you can join the Navy and you're doing duty free shopping in Singapore." And I went, "Right, I'm doing that.
Sold."
Again, it's the what's the path of least resistance? Digging holes, set up hard work.
I sense there's going to be a theme. Pete, do you remember the first time you met Levi?
No.
Really?
No. So, because we were in different divisions, in different squadrons, and in different. So when we went to the academy, you split up into a squadron. I was Charlie, Levi was Alpha. You then went and did your single service training. I was in Jarvis Division. I think you were in Cook Division. So, and so we never really, we would see each other and we would probably know of each other, but it probably wasn't until training crews that we actually started to form, you know, the tenuous bonds of friendship.
How far along was that? Were you in there for 7 years as well, Pete?
No, so I was in for 16 years. I think so. It was just your initial service obligation was 7 years.
Yeah, so I was in for 13 as well. So you know that when we joined up, 7 years seemed like an eternity. Geez, how am I going to make it? And then in a blink of an eye, it's 13 years have gone, and you're going, wow, where did that go? It was amazing.
So after the 7 years, did you say you might as well do this because there was another no pass?
Didn't even enter our heads to leave. Yeah, you know, because really. you're just coming out of being trained. You, at that point, you're probably just becoming useful and you're starting to do the job. And so that, well, in fact, the training, that was probably the one thing. The training never ends. It never really, you just kept going. And it didn't seem like, you know, we were having fun. It was, you know, a great start. You're learning a lot, doing cool stuff.
And that was it. You're doing like really cool stuff. And as a young single bloke, there is no better, you know, pre September 11, 2001, there was no better job than being in the Navy.
So just for the audience, a bloke is a young man. Okay. Just so you know that, because you're going to hear it a lot.
Yeah.
What do you call young women?
Chicks.
Yeah. I know that you want us to say Sheila, but that's just not true. No one actually says that. I mean, apart from parody or satire, the word Sheila does not get mentioned. So maybe we should bring it back, but I kind of feel that the PC crowd at KPMG would lose their mind if we started that up.
I've got two, maybe three listeners, and their minds are going to be blown because that's what we think. When we go to the Outback restaurant here, which is massive, right? It's the blokes and the Sheilas as the restrooms. That's the way it goes. What are the things you took out most from being in the Navy for that long?
For me, it was probably a sense of order. There's a sense of everything that we ever did was always getting from point A to point B, and you would always plan it, and it would be meticulously planned, and you'd spend days or weeks on the plan for what you were going to do. You got out of port and the plan would change. Something would happen, and the phrase that we used was don't fight the white, and that was essentially you'd be doing an exercise. So exercises are inherently made up, and if someone has a piece of paper which has the plan on it, and they're going, well, this is happening, and this missile is doing this, and you'd be going, people would argue with it. They would go, no, but that missile does X, it doesn't do Y. Yeah, and they'd get themselves wrapped around the axles, and they just couldn't comprehend it. But by not fighting the white, just going, okay, that's what's happening. That's what I need to adjust to. Play what's in front of you and keep on going. And it just means, and I think that's probably translated, you know, most to the corporate world, in that you can't get hung up on what happens. You've got a plan, and that's really important. You can't just wing it all the time. But when it does, but when things change, you need to be prepared to change with it. So there's no point fighting to implement what you actually really had planned to do. You've got to adjust and go, okay, this is what's there. And the bit, you know, that I probably still struggle with is you need to be able to, you can't just be completely subservient to the forces that change and go to point C. You still need to determine whether point B is where you want to get to, and what, you know, is it point B or is it somewhere between point B and point C as the forces are sort of gliding? That's probably one of the key things I picked up from the past.
So in the Navy, you just respond to orders. No, we're going this way. So you said, don't fight the why. But when in the corporate world, sometimes you question the why. Is that fair?
I think that is a real misnomer in terms of, there's actually some really good books around this, around like commander's intent. And I think maybe it's an Australian psyche as well, that they're very much in the military, you are given directional intent, but you as a young commander are given a lot of autonomy. You know, I was a submariner, so, you know, it was, again, for six, we used to do 6 hours on, 6 hours off, 6 hours of you're in control. You're driving the submarine. No one's actually telling you what to do. You have, it's actually, whilst it's hierarchical in stature, it's very flat in, and not, you will do, you know, there certainly probably are elements in the military that are more like that, but I hadn't actually thought about that one, Pete, but I thought it was, that is one of the things, planning, but then not taking, so I find even the challenge with the vaccine rollout in Australia, right, which is now a classic mistake in planning, is that because they chose one course and stepped to it and then ignored all other options and then didn't plan for other eventualities. So there was no, they just stuck to that one plan. And so often in, you know, corporate world today, people are going to go, oh, yeah, well, we didn't achieve this because we got surprised by X. Well, that's a failure in planning because you could have thought about those alternates. What's the resilient thing? And we got lots of euphemisms going for all this stuff. But the plan is the basis for change. That was always the piece in the Navy. And then the other one was the course that you were taking is just a pencil line drawn on a chart. You can rub it out. And so don't the path from A to B doesn't have to go through there. You can go around and that ability to think on your feet, adjust the plan, but still achieve the outcome is certainly what has stood us and our peers in great stead in terms of how we've moved into our civilian life.
And I think it's a really good point to sort of just to follow up on. There is the military is definitely hierarchical, and if someone says something, then you do need to do that. But getting back to that intent, that's normally only, that's in case of war break glass type thing. It's never, truly strictly enforced unless it is some sort of safety or material issue at hand. But that directional intent. So I was a navigator, and so I was responsible for getting the ship from point A to point B. And there would be, you would work with the operations officer and the crews, etc. And they would say, we are going on a 3-month-ish deployment, and we need to do X, Y, and Z. And you'd go, and you'd have a big chart of the world or the area, and a pair of dividers, and you'd work out, okay, where can we go? What do we want to do? And it was really you'd do that planning, and so you'd go from right, and so you'd have a plan where we're starting in Sydney, and we need to be in Singapore on this day because we're doing an exercise with the Singaporeans and the Malaysians in this exercise area. What you did between Sydney and Singapore on that date was completely up to you. So you would go, well, we need to fuel, so let's fuel in Darwin because we're going to go up that way, or do we want to go via Perth and do some exercises there and do a port visit and sort of come up as it comes through?
And be in no doubt, Gary, that those port visits were based on which were the best pubs and runs ashore.
Absolutely.
There we go. Now we're talking.
Because no one wants to go to Mackay. It's a shit run.
Yeah.
So this explains a lot because I've been with Pete and Levi together on a few occasions. And in those occasions when we've been together, I've learned that Pete has an inherent honing device and how to get from point A to point B, maybe after a few beers, maybe, but he will always find his way home. That explains why you were a navigator in the Navy, because you knew how to get from point A to point B. Even on land, you're able to navigate yourself from point A to point B, from pub A to home. Let's say
I have a very strong homing beacon.
Yeah. It's a hard trained skill earned over many years, Gary.
Levi, anything stand out in your mind on the Navy and what you learned?
I do. There's probably two things. One, we end up talking a lot about our time in the Navy, even though I've been out of the Navy much longer and a much different corporate career, but I end up coming back to that. We spend a lot more time talking about time in submarines than we do about time doing consulting gigs, but that's a separate bit. The one that I was going to reflect on is the importance of quality and doing things right the first time. And again, the other thing would be that at my early days in the Navy, certainly I saw naval vessels as the means by which they are carting my ass from cocktail party to cocktail party. And certainly it wasn't my priority to get things right. And one of my sort of early captains at the time recognized that in me and sort of pulled me aside and said, I was probably fifth O. If you actually spent a bit of time and got this right the first time, you'd save me a lot of work, you'd save you a lot of work, and you'd be out on the piss with your mates a lot earlier. And it was then, that was kind of like, I'm sure my old man had told me that all my life, but that was the blinding flash of the obvious that all of a sudden I went, oh, hang on, if I spent a bit of time and did this properly, I'd save it a lot of time. That's what I repeat to all of the juniors. Let's get this right the first time. I talk to organizations who spend a lot of time responding to failure demand or incidents, and they're really good at incident and emergency management and these sort of things. But actually, if they spent more time focused on quality, then they wouldn't actually be in that situation. They wouldn't be fixing broken things. They'd be actually adding value. So it was a pretty good lesson at the time that has sort of stuck through me through the ages.
Personally, I view you as a strategic thinker, having worked with you. I don't know if you think you're a strategic thinker or not. I think you are. Is that a foundation for you being a strategic thinker? Is, let me plan this out before we start it so that, you know, we get it right the first time through the strategic avenues that we're going to follow?
Nah. No, I don't think I'm that. It's not that deliberate. But I think probably back to that planning perspective is the ability to break it down into component parts around, well, okay, this is, how do you get to the top of the mountain, to whatever that is, then, okay, this is the path. These are the steps that you need to take. And I think if that is what makes up that sort of strategic thinking piece, I think without trying to sound like a smart ass and fool myself, but that ability to sort of see if I can, if A plus B, we can get to D or E if we pull those things together in the right way, as opposed to seeing things in a silo, is probably overall picture.
Pete, you were going to say something before I interrupted you.
I was about to say, do you think that it might be related to your inherent laziness and path of least resistance? So by understanding, if you do a little bit early, you do a little bit more earlier on, then you don't have to do more later on.
Well done. Well done, Pete.
Yeah, good pulling together of the thing. But I think that is the fact.
One for Pete, zero for Gary on this one.
In fact, I say this to my in fact, that was another one that you work and then you rest. So get it done and then you can rest. And so that was very much the theme around that, and work hard, play hard, all those sort of elements that go into it. But that's definitely the mantra that stuck with me.
But the key pull was you can get to the pub earlier.
Yeah.
That's what sunk in.
Yeah.
Favorite Navy story?
Ooh.
So I'll go with a professional one. So this actually happened at sea as opposed to ashore, because that's where obviously all the best Navy stories occur. We were doing exercises in the Eastern Australian exercise area, so basically just off Jervis Bay, south of Sydney, and I was having a toasted bacon and egg sandwich.
What do you mean by exercises? What does that mean? We're doing exercises.
Push-ups.
So playing around.
Yeah. Jumping jacks? Are you spinning the submarine like a top or something to create a little whirlpool? What's going on? What's exercise?
Yeah, doing burnouts in a ship. exercises are just basically, so exercises are preparations. So you would work with submarines, you'd work with other ships, you'd work with aircraft, you'd work with army personnel, planes.
A lot of communication.
Yeah, practicing. So you'd have
It's training for what you would be doing in war.
Yeah, so I was having a toasted bacon and egg sarnie on the bridge wing. And so for your American listeners, that's a toasted sandwich with bacon and eggs.
No, Pete, it's my job to convert over what you're saying. It's not yours. I'll take care of that. You just be you be Aussie.
Yeah, but I know that you don't know all of our Aussiness.
Yeah, we might have.
We can tell a story about Gary after this.
Favorite Gary stories are part of this. That's the appendix that'll come later. So you're having a toasted bacon and egg sandwich.
Yep, that the captain steward had brought up for me.
Okay.
And I was sort of, and it was probably about 10 to 8 in the morning. And it was, and I was just reflecting on what we'd done over the past 2 hours, in that we had We completed a naval gunfire support exercise, which is basically firing a 5-inch cannon onto land, basically in preparation for supporting land troops, ground troops. We'd done a replenishment at sea, which is where you get to drive two large ships together and being about 24 yards apart. So that's pretty cool. And you're basically going to fill up with fuel. Sorry, my...
Thanks for the yard reference. We don't know meters here. We appreciate that.
Well, interestingly enough, the Navy is all about yards. It's all imperial. So it's all about knots, miles, yards, feet. It's only when you come ashore that you start using meters.
So is that why you always do the hard yards? Is that why you guys always say that?
No.
No. I reckon that's a sporting reference from the good old days.
Gary, 0 for 2. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, so we'd done that. We then did a minefield transit, which is basically preparing to run through a very narrow area that had been cleared of mines with other things happening. And then we'd done a formation anchorage with three other ships into Jervis Bay, you know, and that was, and we did that sort of in a 2.5 hour period over sunrise as it sort of came through.
You're driving.
Yeah.
Is it like a wheel? How do you steer a submarine? What's going on there?
So I wasn't submarines. I was far too good looking to put myself under the water. So I needed to be on the bridge ring with the wind through my hair, sunglasses on, you know, making myself, yeah, you know, everyone going, oh, gee, that navigator's a good looking bloke.
Hang on, Levi, were you on a ship or were you in the submarine?
No, submarine. So ships first and then submarines later. See, it's debatable. I was going to say Pete was not smart enough to go into submarines, but I'm not sure that is quite correct. But we got paid more. We got paid more. And
so the visuals, Pete, he's on when he's got the great hair, great look about him, looking pretty smart up there. Okay, so we got it.
Yeah. And then we did a formation anchorage, and Jervis Bay is a beautiful part of the world. And I was having a conversation with the XO, who's the second in charge of the ship, and just going, so what's everyone else doing? And you compare, like, and that was at 10 to, we'd done all of that before 10 to 8 in the morning. And people are just sort of starting to leave for their commute to work or whatever it might have been. And you're just going, yeah, today was a pretty cool day.
Keeping Australia safe. So that's your story.
Yeah, that was one of my, that was one of my loveliest experiences. And yeah, I really liked that moment.
All before 8 a.m.
All before 8 a.m.
Levi?
Yeah, I was trying to think, well, Peter, there's a few, actually, I was certainly there. Maybe I'm embellishing a little bit to say that I was the officer watch when this happened, but we were, again, this is on a ship, and there was a crusty Commodore, the Commodore of the fleet was there, and he's on the bridge wing again, and he was smoking, I think, his cigar, which was his particular penchant, or a pipe. They used to fucking smoke a pipe, but I think, but this particular one, he used to smoke a cigar, was when we were there, and the captain smoked a cigar, and he's yelled in to me as the officer watch and said, "The watch, the smoke is getting in my eyes." I'm like, okay, sir, sorry. The other bridge wing, so literally 10 feet, like walking 10 feet to the other side, the other bridge wing, sir, is out of the wind. You could, you know, just move over there. "Officer watch, the smoke is getting in my eyes. Turn the ship around." I'm going, "But, sir, we're in company with two other ships and we've got to get to point B. If we turn around, then we're going to have to go faster and get..." "Officer the watch, turn the ship around. The smoke is getting in my eyes." "Aye, aye, sir." And so we turned this, sending flags up and communicating to the other ships, and we literally, three ships turned in company because the Commodore was too lazy to walk 10 feet. So not a bad Navy story.
But that was the exercise, right?
Yeah, but it was good training. In fact, I remember at the time when he said that, I was trying to work out, it was like a quiz that he wanted me to work out what the relative wind was. We used to have to work out for helicopter operations and these sorts of things, where's the wind actually coming from? So I could actually, and I thought that's what he was trying to do, to trick me and quiz me, but it was just that he didn't want to move, and he liked that bridge wing and didn't want the smoke in his eyes. So that was a lesson in in command.
Levi, what got you out of the Navy? What was the driving factor?
I've got to grow up. It's time to grow up at some point and get a real job. And I was at a point where I was at a sort of a natural point in my career where I'd reached the sort of second in command-ish level. And if I stayed on, it would be another 10 years before the next natural level. I was 30, getting a bit of pressure from the missus at the time that this might not be the greatest life for a young family that we were thinking about at the time, where you're away from home for 6 months of the year. And that was the point of departure.
What did you get into?
And so then, you know, it's a big change. You've called it zigs and zags, I think. It was certainly a big piece. We didn't know where we were going to end up, but the path where that had been tread by many before us was to move into consulting because of that sort of generalist think on your feet. I think those sort of skills that we talked about before, that was something that was appreciated by the consulting professional services group. And so there had been a few before. It wasn't an easy path, and I was 30, I think, when I left, and I joined Bearing Point, which was formerly KPMG Consulting then, as a mature age graduate. I started as a consultant right back at the bottom.
At 30. With 13 years of experience.
Yeah. And I think that was it's very hard for people to recognize the skill transfer from submarines to how does this actually get used in the real world. And that's something that a lot of people that come out of the military struggle with. But I was lucky that there were a couple of people who A, have gone before me, and B, recognized that, no, let's just give him a go. And I was able to very quickly and I literally walked out. My first day on the job was the first day of a total business transformation at a telco, and that was my first day on the project. First day in consulting was the first day of the project of a two-year transformation, and I was lucky that I started as the shit kicker, and very pretty quick time, within 12 months I was running the program. And so
you saw it as an advantage to come out at the low end of the totem pole and just smashed it for a year.
I would have taken anything, mate. It was that kind of it. I didn't probably realize I came in probably far too low, but I was very lucky that I was on a project where there was the space to grow very quickly. And I went from a consultant to a senior manager, associate director type level in 2 years.
Really?
So, yeah. So it was just the opportunity. I was really like every 6 months I got promoted. So it was a great time. Hard work.
Yeah, I'm sure. Pete? Why did you jump out?
Probably something very similar, in that I too was at that inflection point between finishing off my navigation career and then starting to head into the command cycle. And yeah, it was going to be another 7 years, and I'd already had one kid at this stage. My wife was pregnant with the second, and my last job at sea was in what they call sea training group, which is where you would leave very early on a Monday morning, and then you would come back on a Thursday night, Friday morning type thing, write up a report, and then go home for the weekend, and then you go and do it again the following week. So it was quite brutal in that sense. And because you would leave at stupid o'clock on a Monday morning, you'd fly out to wherever the ship was. If you're lucky, it was in Sydney. If you weren't, it was in Perth or somewhere else. So you'd have a really long flight. But I'd pack my bag on the Sunday evening and put it at the bottom of the stairs. And so Penelope was two. She just turned two sort of at that stage. And she would get, you could tell that she was upset because she knew that I was going.
She saw the bag.
Yeah. And so, to go and do then another 7 years of life at sea was going, and not just going weekly where you'd be home on weekends, you'd go away for seven, 8 months. I like to tell the story that in the year before I got married, so in the 53 weeks before I got married, I was off the Australian station for 51 of those. So I was either at Christmas Island or in the Gulf.
Isn't there 52 weeks a year, Pete?
There are, but there are 52.
Right, just check.
But I just like you to pick 53 because it just makes the story sound better. Because otherwise, it would be even more.
I thought maybe the Southern Hemisphere added a week or something. So thanks for the clarity. Like, wow.
Yeah, things just take a little bit longer down here. And it was also the other part that I had realized was because I'd seen a couple of others leave before me, and I knew that the corporate world didn't, not that they didn't respect it, but they didn't know how to value your military training and career. And so I knew I was a 33-year-old then or a 35-year-old. I was competing with the 25-year-olds. If I had got out of the Navy, if I had done then the command activity, I'd be a 40-year-old competing with the 25-year-olds because it would be the same sort of scenario, and that wasn't what I wanted to do. So I was lucky again in that people had gone before me and they said, this is one of us, so give him a go, and joined up, and it was away.
Joined up with whom?
With Bearing Point.
Okay.
Yeah, so there were three of us. Levi was obviously there, but the first to go was a guy called Adrian Jagger, who also joined the Navy with us and had lived in, I think he was in Canberra at that stage. And yeah, he'd referred both of us, I think, so he was getting paid bonuses for recruiting us.
Do you think Levi was a positive advocate for you or a negative advocate for you joining Bearing Point?
Levi's always been very positive for me, so he knows that I've got the photos.
Quote, unquote, the photos. Interesting in both of your stories, it was two things. One was family. The second was in order to get the next level up, 7 years for Pete, 10 years for Levi. And you're like, okay. And the family tug on you. I'm just impressed that you managed to find brides in the period in which you guys were in the Navy when, based on a few stories I've heard, there's a lot of competing priorities there. So well done.
Yeah. Well, there's been a couple since then, so that's a separate story.
The appendix podcast.
I was going to say, as I said, on the bridge wings with the wind through my hair, I was a fairly good-looking rooster in my youth.
That's just not true.
Is that a lie? I'm calling lie.
That is a lie. I can categorically say I'm calling bullshit.
Okay. For the audience, a rooster is a very handsome young man with great hair. And Pete is very handsome. He's got great hair. And he's a ginger, too. So for all you young ladies out there that like the ginger, Pete's your guy.
All three of you in the world. But this is clearly not a video podcast. It's audio only because it's a great face for audio podcasting.
Hey, this face was born for a podcast. I can tell you that. Born for radio, this guy. How was it going? Oh, what advice do you have for people that, you know, are graduating high school to go into the military for service? What's your perspective on that?
So I think it always changes, but I think it's a great career for a young kid. It's it gives you direction, it gives you stability, and it gives you a set of skills that you can't compare or and easily transferred. But everything I did in the Navy, everything I do in the corporate world now, the basics were learned in the Navy. And I think that the best thing for me, and I, you know, I always reminisce about it, is that pure sense of camaraderie. And so I have friends in the Navy that I have friends in the civilian world, but they are not the same bonds that I share with my friends from the Navy. I want to say an amazing group of people, but they're just a bunch of reprobates that I enjoy hanging out with. And I think part of that comes through from if you're going away for 6 months, you're on somewhere between a 90-meter or 140 meters of steel. You are with the same people every day for somewhere between 12 to 16 hours per day. After about week one, you've got past the idle chit-chat. And you're getting deep into their life, what they did before everything else. And when it's the fifth month and it's 2 a.m. in the morning and you're in the middle of the guts watching, you're trying to keep yourself awake, you're finding out a lot about people.
It's great training for lockdown. I was thinking this the first time that we went into a 112-day lockdown in Melbourne.
Which lockdown is this for you now? It just started today for the audience. So
lockdown 5. After 18 cases, we've locked 5 million people down. Give me a break. But anyway, but yeah, I thought if I was had a little bit more time, that would be a good book to write around how to survive lockdown based on 5 tips of living in a submarine. For those points that actually that's the story that I should have told before. But anyway, the life in the submarine. This is my story for how I describe, which is kind of lockdown around. Yeah, people always ask, it doesn't matter, I've been top of a corporate career, run big transformation programs, no one gives a shit, no one ever asks me about it. They always ask me what's life like in submarines. And the story I sort of tell is that it was Sydney to Hawaii, it's 21 days, and I can remember sitting on the periscope, we're at 200 metres, sitting on the periscope combing underwater, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, the lights are all out, you've heard all of the stories that everyone's ever told before. And I'm going, this is the worst job on earth. It's so boring. We haven't seen a thing for a week. And then we get to Hawaii and the supply officer meets you on the wharf and hands you the keys to the Sheridan Minor Surf Rider. And you get $105 US a day in subsistence allowance. So I had, here's $1,000 US for your first week in Waikiki. And you go, this is the fucking best job on earth.
So if I recall, I remember the story, you said the most exciting thing in the 21 days when you had to pivot the submarine, how far?
1 degree. 1 degree at Fiji. You literally, it's a straight line for 21 days except for a 1 degree turn. And so we got everyone at action stations to do this 1 degree turn and then it's over. And we went back to normal and being bored out of our brains.
And then you get to Waikiki is at the end of that, and how long did that, so they gave you your full allotment in the first day. Did that last the 7 days?
Nah, come on, Gary. Nah. Mind you, we actually broke down in Hawaii. Maybe this is a separate trip, and we had like maybe 5 weeks there. And what we very quickly got to, such a great place, is, okay, if we do, $5, $2 Mai Tais from 3 to 5. Go to Moose McGillicuddy's and it's $2 beers from 5 to 7, and you can get cheap. And so you can make that $105 stretch a long way.
As long as you plan out properly from one place to another. Hey, switching text, what do you look for in young people? Because I know you guys are still in consulting and you're meant to put teams together. So what do you look for? What characteristics, what traits?
It's definitely attitude. So if you've got the right attitude, that sort of can do, give it a go mentality, and how is this person going to be fit into the broader team in terms of that cohesion? You want to get a diverse group, but how is this person going to contribute from an attitude perspective, and the rest you can train. So that's definitely that sort of first trait.
Pete?
Sorry, my internet is starting to struggle. I missed it.
So Pete wants a positive internet connection for young people. That's his key trait for the young people. He might have to drop off. Not sure. Pete's
down.
Pete's frozen.
Hmm. And it's not a good look for Rooster.
I do like Rooster. So what do you look for in young people, Pete?
I guess it's more about personality in the first instance. Someone that is easy. Sorry. I'm not looking for someone that I can be friends with or that it's easy to get along with, but someone that knows what they want to do and wants to be involved and active, as opposed to someone who, it's not that I don't like ambitious people, but I find that really ambitious people are not the best team members, because they're all about themselves and they want to just, drive up that path, etc. The best people for me are people that understand you can have a conversation with, and they understand what goes on in the world and how it all fits together. And then you can sort of, and they'll come with different opinions and views, and that's part of life, and that's good. But it does help you sort of, it means that you'll be able to work with them. You can train them. You can understand, what makes them tick, and you can sort of work together. And that natural progression and ambition will come with good work and management. It's not, I think people can get too wrapped around the axles on, I want to be this. So then I've got to do this, 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 and this to get there. And it's like a tick and flick exercise. And I just don't like working with people like that.
I actually had this conversation with a young person last night at the pub where they asked about that sort of piece. And I think a lot of the time people think, you know, young people think, oh, I've got to do this job because I want to get to there. And they then sometimes block out the opportunity that's right in front of them because they think they've got to jump through. No, I'm hanging out to do this one. But my advice is always take the opportunity that's in front of you and trust in the process, if you will, and the karma of the world will come around. And if you're open to those things and you can take it on, then it will stand you in good stead.
So that's two pieces of good advice for Levi thus far. It's get it right the first time and then take the opportunity in front of you. Pete, you're got to catch up here. What's the advice you most give to young people or your daughters? Well, your daughters are young people.
So the most common piece of advice that I give my daughters is, or it's probably more of a statement than advice, but it's not weird. It's different.
Don't go out with ginger people.
like your mom. Don't make the mistake your mom made. We threw him off. Now he can't think.
No, it's just take life as it comes. It's the, yeah, and in all seriousness, it isn't weird. It is different. And there are different people out there in the world, and everyone together makes the world what it is. So just enjoy it.
What do you mean it isn't weird? It's different.
So people are very, I think people can be very judgmental, and Levi is very judgmental about my ginger hair, but people are judgmental and they'll say, oh, that's just weird, man. Oh, that's wrong. Like, you'd never do it like that. And it's not, you know, if someone wants to go out there and do body surfing nude at 3 a.m. in the morning with their purple hair, that's their thing. So that's just different. They're not hurting anyone. They're respecting others. Just let them get on and do it.
This is a family friendly podcast, Pete. The whole naked thing.
I'm pretty sure I said nude. They weren't just body surfing. They weren't doing anything, you know, illegal or immoral.
No, I'm talking about you're not wearing any clothes right now. So would you mind covering up?
That was a request that you made to me in the interview, in the invite.
Okay, let's move on.
Actually, Pete, the advice that I thought that you often do give, which I think is good, is the customer is always right, but the client is often wrong.
The client can be wrong.
Right? I like that.
Yeah, and I think that it's in our job. It is, we're not there just to agree with everything that you know, client says, and we're there to challenge, and provide healthy challenge so that actually they get to the right outcomes. And I think if people sort of, again, it goes back to that hierarchical command and control type structure. Don't be afraid to challenge if you see something going the wrong way, and that's where you're adding value, is to really challenge, not just be a yes man the whole way through.
Like it.
It's a good one.
I think the other one that comes from that, and again, it's a military thing, is that you can't do it all yourself. You know, you do need support, you do need a team. And even if someone does something that you wouldn't have done or would have done it in a different way, to a certain extent, you've got to be accepting of that, because otherwise you'll get, you know, you won't get past halfway because you're too busy, you know, micromanaging, worrying about those details that in the greater scheme of things don't matter.
Great point.
Yeah, there's certainly a maintenance of control and direct, and it's like Levi was saying before, it's that directional intent. So I want to get here. Okay, I wouldn't have taken that path, but I can still see that we're going to get there. So let's do it.
Like it. Yeah. We can cascade that message down into some team members. So one final kind of heavy question before we get into some fun stuff. What's your perspective on building strong relationships? You're both in consulting for quite a while now. So how do you approach building a relationship with anybody, with other consulting team members, with clients?
I think you can't underestimate the importance of relationships. And I think even just through COVID and lockdown, et cetera, it heightens, you understand probably the importance and the value of relationships even more, because it's much harder to build new relationships via video. So maintaining those, that's probably the thing that I'd say is maintain your relationships from throughout your career, really invest in that and take the time to reach out to those people that you've worked with in the past. So there's that piece, but absolutely the way to build that relationship is that you have to be open to being vulnerable yourself. If you share a little bit more about your, not just be about work all the time and share a bit about my life, my family, my interests, etc., that's you then get, be open to that then people will respond to that with staying to share, and then you can start to build that relationship from there. But it's so important, and ignore it at your peril.
And I think that point is really important, Levi. You can't underestimate it. It's not all about work. You know, the best relationships are not purely work focused. It's the I know Levi's kids, I know Gimp's kids, I know everyone. It's the, and you know what they do, what makes them, not what makes them tick, but what sort of drives them or gives them an interest, etc. Because if everyone was, if you're just looking at it from a work perspective, and just conversing in that way, again, it goes back to that conversation I was having before, is this is just a transactional conversation, and are you just using me as a leapfrog up because that's what you've got to do, that's the box you've got to tick for this particular level, or are you actually interested in me? And if you are, then I'm interested in you, and I will, you know, move heaven and earth for you, or as much as I can.
People sense that. And just for the audience, Gib is a common friend of Levi and Pete, who I've met. Very good guy.
The Gib.
Yeah. That's the one good thing about the Navy, is you get good nicknames.
He's a lawyer, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, barrister. Hope he's doing well. Do you guys have time for some fun questions?
Yeah.
Always.
It's a relative term. Favorite movie is what?
I can't go past Team America. There was a stage when I was navigating a ship called HMAS Manure. It was quite late in my career. And so as the navigator, my job was to get the ship alongside by 10 a.m. And I would do that, and I would get charged a bottle of champagne. Yeah. The old days, you get charged a bottle of champagne for each minute you were late or early. So you'd always have that first line at 10 a.m. And I was pretty good at that. But once that was done and I'd returned the bridge equipment, to the binoculars, some pencils and rubbers and stuff like that, I would then, like, that was my job done. Then the XO and the engineers had to, you know, they had to basically make the ship pretty. They had to refuel the ship. The pusser would get the, you know, the new food on, et cetera, et cetera. But I was done. So I would then, you know, at about 10:15, 10:20, I would then go down to the wardroom, lean back in the lazy boy and put on Team America because I was just waiting until leave was piped.
Team America. So just for the audience, a rubber in this instance is an eraser. Levi, favorite movie?
I would go Blues Brothers. And it comes from watching it with my old man, and it's just funny, good music. Music's a big part of what I do. So, yeah, it's you can't go past the classic.
It is. Favorite meal?
Lamb.
Chili mud crab.
Okay, just for the lamb in Australia is off the chart great. It is. Lamb in America, ugh, can't take it. They don't know how to prepare it. It's always dry, bone dry. But in Australia, oh my God, is it good. A favorite vacation spot?
Somewhere on the beach.
Any beach.
Yeah, Heron Island for me. Heron Island is a great place on the Great Barrier Reef. It's one of the few places where, well, there's sort of turtles and turtle hatchings, and you can walk off the beach and you're snorkeling on the Great Barrier Reef with sharks and rays. It's unbelievable. So I probably shouldn't tell too many people about it, but you can't get there anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Nobody can get there. Fantasy career. Do anything you'd be great at, or what would you do?
I think Levi was going to say porn star.
I
thought Buck Naked was going to come out.
Yeah. No, it was one that was going with the porn star. It was always you, Collins. But No, you go rock star.
Yeah.
You definitely go rock star. That would be
right.
Unbelievable. Like, it just that when you see the people, yeah, I don't really like Ed Sheeran that much, but when you see just him and a guitar, and yeah, it's not a ginger thing. But he's just very repetitive. But, you know, the others, when you see that one person and a guitar in front of entertaining 10,000 people or whatever it might be, just that must be an incredible.
Am I right? And you write your own songs and.
Yeah.
And rock stars aren't held up to be role models. You can pretty much do whatever you want.
Well, their role modeling is all of the bad, but like all of the fun.
The role modeling, how to have a gosh darn good time. Pete,
yeah.
Fantasy career?
Yeah, I don't know, but I think it's probably anything that you would do in front of a large crowd, you know, whether it's a sports person or a musician or whatever it might be.
Anything?
That must be having watched it, watch concerts, watch games, etc., and the electricity that you feel when that roar goes through the crowd, imagine being on the receiving end of that.
So just for the audience, Pete plays rugby, which astounds me. So I'm sure with the hundreds of thousands of people that watch you on a Saturday, I'm sure that just generates a lot of excitement inside of you, right, Pete?
It does. So we played a game in the Solomon Islands, and it was on the Solomon Islands National Day. And so we played it, you know, down in downtown Honiara, and we played the police side. But there was probably 2,000 people around the ground because it was their national, you know, the National Day of Markets, etc. And that was just amazing.
How good, you know, is that?
So that's 2,000 people laughing at you every time that these big Melanesian men just destroy you. And they go, you know, one dude had his knee, like there was a coconut on the field, so he landed on the coconut on his knee and it basically cut it up.
Don't be racist, man.
I got to have to edit that out, Pete. What are you thinking? Got to clean up half of everything you said. Okay, a concert. Any artist, dead or alive, who would you have to see? And the venue.
Oh, right now, in fact, Gary, I was going to say, you could. I'll live vicariously through you, but I would go and see Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit at the Ryman Theatre in Nashville. Got to go and see it. And I just follow on Instagram and all that sort of stuff, but it's happening in October. And he does like a week there, I think, in October every year. And that's the one.
Okay. So I literally talked to a friend of mine about going there. I just listened to a Sunday sit down podcast with Brad Paisley and Willie Geist, and they were at the Ryman Theater just going off about, it was a church and it's majestic with, and that's the home of when they were doing country music, they didn't know what it was, what they were doing. They just started. So they were just trying to figure it out. So now we can't have horns or we can't have this. Okay. What you're telling me is I need to make the pilgrimage over to Nashville for that and then get you on WhatsApp and record it. Okay. Done. I do that for you, Levi. Pete?
So I'm looking backwards and I'd like to see Cream at Royal Albert Hall.
Ooh, well done. What's Royal Albert Hall? Can you translate that into American for us?
It's a musical hall in London.
Oh.
I don't know entirely where, but yeah, it's used for many concert venues.
Gary is 0 for 3 on references.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a bad one. I thought it was in Australia.
I think you're thinking of the Prince Albert, which is something different.
Right. Okay. I never asked this one. I'm going to ask it. If you could be born or live in any era, past or future, what would you choose?
So I was born in 1973. I'd probably be probably 15 years in 58.
You'd want to be born in 58?
Yeah. Or maybe 50. Yeah, so maybe, yeah, no, 58 would have been fine because then I would have hit the corporate world in the 80s and 90s, and I reckon I would have been set for that.
Okay, so you want a 15-year back, so 58. Levi, any era or a future?
Yeah, I think that sort of maybe 50s America where it was just so full of hope and opportunity, and that just seems to be a pretty amazing time, and that would be pretty good. 70s for the rock star. 1971 is like a pretty seminal year in music. That would have been a good time to be alive. You know, right, Led Zeppelin, Bon Scott's, they're just hitting their strap with AC/DC, Sticky Fingers album comes up, all of that was a pretty good time as well, but I don't know, we're not doing too bad.
All expense paid trip to the moon, would you go?
Nah. Well, like, mate, that's like being in a submarine. There's nothing, you can't get out, there's nothing to do. But I don't get that whole thing.
Right, I don't either. Pete?
So, yes, no. So I get going to space and seeing the Earth from orbit.
The planet Earth is blue. Yeah.
It's not flat.
Yeah, definitely not.
Kyrie Irving. Well, Kyrie Irving thinks it's flat. Let's be honest. There's a curvature. Richard Branson said so.
Must be true.
Any guilty pleasures?
I don't feel guilty.
Yeah.
I'm not guilty. Moving on, fast food restaurant, your favorite one?
Currently, it's probably, and I haven't had it for such a long time, but it's Bell's Hot Chicken.
That's a good one. Yeah, that's a good one. You stole it.
I think I did that. Yeah, I did. I was in Sydney. Somebody told me. It might have been you guys. You said you had to have it. Yeah, that's good.
Hot chicken sandwich with an Arnold Palmer. It was very, very good. Very good lunch.
Levi, anything spring to mind? Is that it?
Yeah, that would be it.
Any superpower, what would you want?
You go first.
You'd want to fly, right? Clearly, everyone would want to fly. That's an obvious one. X-ray vision.
Oh, come on. For what? X-ray vision. All right, this podcast is heading south a bit too quickly. Pete, did you want to comment on the superpower?
Tap into what, sorry?
Like superpower, which one you'd want.
Oh, right. No.
Okay, see if this works. Three-part question. I give you $100, $1,000, $10,000. What would you spend it on? So $100, what would you buy?
Alcohol.
Pete?
Yes.
$1,000?
I was thinking whether it's beer or rum, but yeah. You probably can't get a really good rum for $100.
Elskam Hall? So $1,000, you got to spend it. You can't save it. What would you do with it?
Travel. You definitely, right now, I could save that for the $10,000.
For the $1,000, I'd have a good meal. So like really, really good meal at a restaurant with, you know, nice wine, etc.
I might even invite someone. That's good. Maybe have a few people. That would be good.
In Vegas, they have these buffets. So for like $50,
is that still a thing?
They're coming back, few and far between. And there's a plate going behind, and you say, "Give me this, give me that," because. Yeah, right now, but I don't think it hasn't hit stride yet. $10,000.
Yeah, that'd be a holiday, travel somewhere.
Yeah, that's the business class trip somewhere.
Well, I always recall the trip you took with your son when you had to go to Spain, and I thought that was fantastic. And I also like that your son knows a lot about cheese. So when he went to Paris or France, he saw, you know, to write a book on it. Final question. You could have a conversation with anybody, dead or alive. Who would it be?
So the most annoying part about this is you asked me last week and I didn't have an answer, and I thought I'd go away and think about it. And I did, and I still haven't.
Nothing. This can be a toughie. I just read a book on Da Vinci, and holy moly.
Yeah, that would be pretty good. Turing, I just read a book. That reminded me, I just read a book, Machines Like Us, right, which is, it plots a sort of different reality, a different history if Alan Turing actually lived, and he makes all technology sort of open source, and yeah, it's a very different world order. It's quite good, actually. It's Machines Like Us. I think, is it Machines Like Us or Machines Like Me? Machines Like Me. Good book.
Gentlemen, I really appreciate you getting on. I know it's early there and you're at the beginning of a lockdown, so thank you so much. Good to see you both.
Got nothing else to do.
Thank you.
Thanks, mate. It was fun.